Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. I was at the first meeting in 1993 and lots of them since then. Have to thank Ramon for his continuous kindness throughout that period, also during through a whole month visit some time ago. So it's a great pleasure to be here again. And I'm going to start with a number of apologies, really. And the first one is to apologize. It's such a general title. For various reasons, I had I had a part of last year when actually I was completely away from the university, everything academic. I was doing something else, and people say, I need your title tomorrow, and that is the title. That's the title. The abstract is also not quite what is in your abstract, because I don't actually, looking at the title in more detail of density functional theory, well, it's actually been quite a long time since I've been involved in any development of density functional theory, although I use it quite a lot. So there are three topics I want to talk about. The first is our use of density functional theory. So actually rather old, you're bringing an old-fashioned aspect that's still surprisingly powerful, and some of the materials-related work that we've been doing with modern periodic DFT at Bristol. I'm afraid I'm going to be a bit of a traitor and talk about two new projects that I've been doing with my colleague Fred Manby, who's actually applying quantum chemical method rather than DFT. But I do first of all want to convince you that I do sort of have DFT credentials. Long before DFT was actually generally accepted in the chemistry community, I spent a PhD working for Norman March in Oxford, and so a lot of that actually ended up with fitting functionals for all sorts of exotic things. Not so much the there was a little bit about the exchange and the correlation energy, we should have carried on with that, but also, which are less important these days, properties as like the kinetic energy and part of the momentum space stuff, had its origin in looking at functionals for properties like the mean momentum. And then I decided, even then I was a bit fed up with density functional theory, and I would move, and I got a job in a well-known chemical company which no longer exists. And I thought, good, that's it for density functional theory, that's it, I'll be doing something else, hopefully getting lots of money in the chemical industry, ho-ho, or what have you. And so I moved to this chemical company, and I met my new boss, and he says, I want you to start simulating some materials. And by the way, we use density functional theory to extract the intra-atomic potentials in these materials. So there's the code, and get off and do it. So, at that point I was sort of thinking, there's probably no escape. There'll never be any escape for me. Density functional theory, and what was actually being used there was modification of the Kim Gordon model for intermolecular forces that dates from 1972 originally, basically in various modifications used for ionic and semi-ionic solids, where you assume the change of the direct bonding was rather small, that when things just overlapped, and all that happened was that densities were superposed. So the input into the model, summarised the model there, the input was the gas phase cation densities, or anion densities, usually at the Hartree-Fock level. With the case of the anions, you actually solve the Hartree-Fock equations with some account of the allowing for the Madelung field in the crystal, usually assuming full ionicity. And of course, to do this approach, you'd have to make some assumption about whether you're going to have 2 plus, 2 minus, plus 3, plus 1, or whatever. But the point of that actually it is, for ionic solids, the crudity of that model still gives ionic potentials that still work remarkably well, and we still use those today to generate for classical simulations generating potentials. And dare I say, they will give lattice parameters typically to less than 2%. There are a few modifications around of what the types of functionals you can put in, which we won't bother to go into now, and useful for many bulk and surface properties too. And one of the advantages that is certainly useful in our own simulation work is that, of course, it gives you behavior over a range of internuclear separations, not just those using the parameterization of empirical potentials, which may be using just the values, you may just generate new potentials at one or two particular internuclear separations. There's a rather neglected paper by David Cooper and co-workers in Philosophical Magazine from 90, which actually compares the density functional potentials with those from various spin-coupled valence bond methods, which went quite along, it showed some of the agreements that were actually there. And so I've actually chosen a few examples of where we use those. Now, I suppose where do we use those now? In properties where ab initio calculation not really feasible. This is a graph showing about garnet mixtures. Garnet is quite complex minerals, but with cubic symmetry, lots of pyrope is a magnesium garnet, grusha is a calcium garnet. This is the excess heat capacity of the 50-50 mixture. So this is that contribution to the heat capacity which you do not get by doing a linear interpolation between the two. And it involves doing a lot of studies of the orderings of the very subtle orderings of the calciums and the magnesium ions in that. So there's probably a couple of thousand different orderings in there, and it compares compares the theory in red with the experiments in black, for example. We're actually using them now for a very different project, which is due to nuclear waste. Basically in Britain, unless we go back to nuclear power, the lights are going to go out. So there is renewed interest in nuclear waste disposal and novel containment forms for it. And here are simulations of some quite complex oxides: gadolinium zirconium oxide, gadolinium titanium oxide, which are, for those which are defective, which are pyrochlore type structures related to the fluorite type of crystal structure. And basically it's a classical simulation in which you give one of the atoms to represent the uranium or the nasty that's there, that's decayed, and then there's a recoil atom with a tremendous kinetic energy, and it rockets around all over the place, causing lots of damage. So empirical potentials usually behave particularly badly there, because we need intratomic potentials with at least which is going to tell us at least something about the quite high up on the repulsive wall. And the actual lattice parameters and the elastic constants, that's equivalent of related to the derivatives of the energy with respect to distorting the structure, for those two were just comparable to any that you would have from most versions of DFT. And so that's one of our new current projects, and it's actually rather interesting and a good similarity thing as to how the titanium and the zirconium turn out to be so different in these materials. So now those of all, so that up to now, that was all using the Kim Gordon electron model for intermolecular forces. Of course, another way of approaching things is just simply generate a potential energy surface using DFT and then obtain your potential by fitting to that. And we've played a little bit with that over the years. Again, we'll try to do this. We're interested a lot in thermal effects and lattice expansion. And lattice expansion calculated by direct free energy minimization requires very precise calculations of the free energy, and really we do that by a lot of the time by calculating the vibrational frequencies using these potentials. And this is the thermal expansion of magnesium chloride, both which is anisotropic in the A and the C directions. What's interesting about that being LDA, of course, is that there's no dispersion interactions explicitly in the in that DFT, but nevertheless, and despite it, you know, there are many ways you can generate these potentials from the potential energy surface, which here we've got by varying lattice parameters and basis atom positions in various ways. But that's since been confirmed experimentally. So so it introduces in, despite the exclusion of dispersion. We were talking at lunchtime about predicting things. We had a prediction earlier. We do quite a lot of structure prediction in Bristol. For a range of our colleagues and in the materials, and to do that, we often do that really by data mining databases and running lots of possibilities with GGA, periodic GGA, DFT using GGA, that sort of thing. This was one that I found quite fun from a few years ago when we predicted basically graphene zinc oxide, and we were brave enough after seeing this emerge from optimization, we actually wanted something else to happen, it didn't, in making the prediction. And of course, now, yes, it's graphite-like. When you have more than one sheet, it's going to form the graphite-like sheets. Here, the dispersion really isn't an issue because of the ionicity of the bonds. And for larger than 18 layers, you go from graphitic to this graphitic light, back to the wurtzite structure. That's the bulk structure of zinc oxide. And then we're very pleased, well, they didn't send us an email, we just read it ourselves, that had actually been observed. And there's actually quite a lot of interest in zinc oxide graphene sheets these days. And so, I'm not going to predict the results of the football this evening. I will rely on the psychic octopus, I think, for that, which seems to receive a lot of prominence. But we use DFT a lot. I mean, and I certainly have enjoyed seeing it from fitting functionals that perhaps in my DFT I didn't see any point of, to actually using it routinely to do lots of hopefully interesting applications in material science, in computational material science and computational mineralogy. Now, I can't not give a talk here without mentioning the English tea time. I think I've mentioned tea time, the English tea time, every time I give a talk here. Which also, and even to me, it feels like, you know, you have this very English tea time, and I usually go and talk to one of my colleagues who asks me a question. I say, that's no problem, I can think of that in 5 minutes or 5 hours, and usually it takes me about 5 years as a result. And so it can be dangerous tea time. Now, the second half of the talk is actually all based on applications which arose not from tea time, but arose from coffee time and my colleague Fred Manby, who is a molecular quantum, who is a quantum chemist, who I'm sure many people here know. And he bought a very nice espresso maker, so it wasn't tea time at all. But I was very tempted by this espresso. I've grown to like it, actually. And so we would have many discussions about DFT and the role of what possible quantum chemistry could have for these types of problems. And I should say that everything I'm now going to say is a collaboration with Fred and other co-workers of his, and it would have been quite impossible without his contribution. It's all a collaboration with him. I suppose I go to a lot of talks. I go to a lot of talks with people improving density functional theory and functionals, and I'm now going to say that much as I like it, I can see that there's no clear route for systematic improvement of DFT results. There may be some people here that disagree with that, but that's my, I think that's probably my considered opinion. There's the dispersion problem. We've heard a lot about that in this conference. Of course, progress is being made. I never quite know, like with the interatomic potentials, so they can work a lot of the time fine, and then perhaps like the psychic octopus, just get it wrong on an important occasion. Fred would lecture me that the molecular quantum chemistry that I'd left many, many, many years before, said, well, they're systematically improvable. However, implementation with periodic boundary conditions are not straightforward. Now, I know in some cases there is now periodic NP2, for example, and people are working on this, but that's actually, you know, that is hard. Overall these espressos, we thought what we could do. And I'm going to talk about two of the ongoing projects. And the first one, which for a reason I don't quite understand, is called hierarchical method for solids. And really, the idea is very, very simple. We just want to estimate correlation energy from those of small clusters. And so then if I have the Hartree-Fock energy for that solid of interest, then I'll take an estimate that the correlation energy will be, as I've written there, will be the molecular correlation energy plus this last term, the correlate plus a correction term. And this Fred and Co can whirl away and estimate this in principle, though that's turned out to be more problematic than I expected it to be. There are available codes and such forth, and the correlation energy will estimate from the cluster calculations on finite clusters. But what course we need to do to that is to need to eliminate surface, corner and the edge effect from the cluster calculations. And so the basic idea is actually really rather simple, which is to assume there is then a the correlation energy, the correction rather, I'm sorry, I'm getting myself lost in lots of notation, but this correction to the correlation energy, which just from the molecule, we're going to say is dependent on what its coordination is in the cluster. So that will be at corners, there will be edges, there will be faces, and there will be bulk. So I have basically an equation with four unknown constants. So if I do four clusters, I can then use those. I have four simultaneous equations, which I can extract, and I can solve those. And this is an example. We've done most work on lithium hydride. This is the experimental lattice parameter. And here's a variation. Here's basically the results for each of those individual constants for the corners, edges, and faces, and then in particular the bulk number E111 down there. This is a bit of the expansion of that graph, so that we see the cluster size n along the along the x-axis, and then the scale is in millihartree along the y-axis. And then I can imagine coming along here, I can do four clusters with 32 atoms in all together, and this is the value I get. And you get a rather semi-erratic variation. You can see that where the big gaps come, where the big changes come in, is when you start changing from clusters that are just chained. So there's no chains of atoms, of LIHs anymore, and here corresponds to having no sheets. And as I said, for the bulk, all I care about is E111. And you can ask, well, there's lots of possible clusters you could pick up. Well, I have for any given cluster size of such and such. How do the results change? And the lines in red show typically what, depending on which clusters I choose, what the resulting variation in E11 typically is. The additional, I suppose I should also, but of course it's rather sensible, because to choose clusters which look as bulk-like as possible. But for these, this gives you a good impression, if I just did some at random, what should happen. If you change, Fred gives me courses in the different methods and basis sets. Actually, it doesn't seem the variation with cluster size seems pretty invariant to the actual details of the calculation or the basis set. And what that means, in principle, you could start playing games when you could do a cruder calculation or cheaper calculation on a larger cluster, and by doing calculations at higher levels on smaller clusters, use that to correct the values for the larger clusters. And all this graph on this slide is the previous graph, just showing the differences between the various different current lines. So in principle, we have that game that we can, corrections can be made at small cluster sizes without introducing large errors. So from that we can then aim to estimate what the cohesive energy of LIA, we can use that, because that's only the correction term, i.e. the non-molecular bits of the correlation energy. And you can imagine, and you can combine a whole lot of different terms together. There are some, Fred discovered that doing the period, well, with various other people, some of whom I think are in the audience, that actually it wasn't, it was a much harder task from the outside to see that getting the periodic Hartree-Fock number was harder than foreseen. And there are a number of other corrections here for basis set completeness, and then a core correlation correction, for example. There is one use of DFT here, which is to calculate GGA phonons and use that to calculate the zero point energy contribution. That gives a final answer. And to compare that, this graph then compares the difference between LIH and LID, all together. This is now with the experiment. This is actually not quite experiment. It's allowing for the thermal expansion. And there's a bit of dissent about what the bulk modulus. The bulk modulus, that's effectively the related to the second derivative of the energy with respect to the volume. There's a wide variety of the experimental values there. The theory, I think we have to start to have a definite view about what the bulk modulus of LIH is there. And as a result, we can play the plain sort of game with LID. The only difference there will be the zero point energy. There are results for that. I should say the experiment cohesive energies aren't that simple either. I mean, that normally looks at looking lots of experiments and doing Hess's law cycles and deciding there's a bit of uncertainty there. But anyway, I think overall I would say that we're fairly confident of getting the total cohesive energy in this particular case to within about one millipartree. And there's a quantum Monte Carlo study by the people at UCL we've been working with also indicating a reasonable value, a very similar value to our resulting value there. And so this is a sort of cheap and cheerful method, well, not necessarily cheap, but certainly a cheerful method, which I like, because otherwise you've heard my solid state talks. Now I'm very keen on the local environments and distinguishing things that are at edges and surfaces and in the bulk. And this is a bit like its electronic structure equivalent. From the E011 number in the simultaneous equations, I can actually extract without any effort at all again what the surface energy is of lithium hydride, or at least here is the 001 surface energy. Again, the UCL collaborators have run quantum Monte Carlo here, which required a frozen core approximation. But anyway, all in all, it's pretty reasonable that we can identify that we have a reasonable value for the surface energy of LIH. I would comment, however, that there's no experimental number, but there's one very important physical term not included in here, which sadly is very important in determining almost all surface energies of this type of compound, which is the relaxation of the surface that takes place relative to the bulk separation. And that's something that's not readily going to be amenable to this method. We've had a play with neon as well, where, as we heard the other day, the Hartree-Fock is entirely repulsive. Again, here are some results now for the cohesive energy, this time in micro Hartree. How much longer do I have?
A couple of minutes.
Right, I should go on very quickly. Again, we want a systematically improvable method for liquids. The Carparanello MD, very powerful, but unfortunately, actually, it doesn't produce, for example, it produces overstructured water at ambient temperatures. Probably the melting temperature of it really is more like 100 degrees too large, and the diffusion constant is too small. Again, potentials very sophisticated, lots of reparameterization required. And with Fred and a very, very gifted postdoc we have called Darragh O'Neill, we've basically been trying, do a simulation, a Monte Carlo simulation of water by means of using a many body expansion, but basically using no parameters whatever. So there's a 2 and 3 and 4 body, in principle 2 body terms and 3 body terms. For atoms close together, we calculate quantum mechanical contributions for dimers and trimers. for well-separated molecules, we just calculate everything classically. So there's electrostatics by doing a multipolar expansion. We have a self-consistent model for the induction energy. That's important, as that wipes the, effectively allows for many body effects there. And there is dispersion, which we could have calculated, but have used the C6 to C10 coefficients from the literature. For periodic systems, we do Ewald summations for all the multipoles. And again, as I say, just to emphasize, many body contributions are accounted using, as I say, fully self-consistent induction energy calculations. And we have a cutoff of around 4.5 angstroms. Well, larger than that, everything is classical, and below that, everything is quantum mechanical. But still no parameters input. I mean, we do assume a damping function, a particular form for the Tantonis damping a form for the damping of the induction energies. So that's an assumption, but there are no input parameters. These are some results for water clusters first that show that you're having just two body interactions, so that doesn't work very well, but the two body plus the self-consistent induction agrees very well with two and three body. The Monte Carlo method works by applying only a random move to only a single monomer at a time, which has the advantage I only have to calculate the interaction involving that monomer all the time. I will miss all of those. So our first real calculator, NVT, it's not NPT yet, NVT, but this is within periodic boundary conditions. Nothing like enough trial moves, only just over 500,000. But as I say, there are no parameters put in here at all. Here are details of the various multipole expansions, the degree of multipoles we've used. And here's the resulting RDF. Now, of course, we haven't fitted it to any density. So now MP2 gets the dimer distance in water wrong, so we wouldn't quite expect that, but we're doing rather well here in terms of not getting an overstructured liquid. That one, the error bar, is well within all the experimental error bars, which are given by the dashed lines here. The green line added on this one is the DFT, where you see the overstructuring that the DFT, which actually is also true in hybrid, the hybrid equivalent of that I'm going to, this is actually proving rather promising, and we hope we'll move on from that to all sorts of liquids at higher temperatures. You start seeing the disappearance of that second peak, as we should. That's an energy profile. But basically, we're hoping, again, to have a parameterization-free sort of Monte Carlo simulation and general package for liquids. Hopefully, been quite too long. That was the summary. I would like to thank all the people, many projects there, many people there. I haven't been able to acknowledge all of them in passing. I'd particularly like to mention the UCL lot. And I'm sorry for overrunning, and thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Allen, for your very interesting talk. And I'm sure there will be many questions. However, in view of the time, I will allow for one. Maximum. Yes, please.
I have to say a few words in favor of DFT. I mean, one of the big advantages of DFT is that it is robust and can be applied. I mean, with a dispersion correction, you can apply DFT to almost any solid, liquid, whatsoever. While MP2, which you can afford for large systems, is restricted more or less to electronically simple systems. So already for the benzene liquid, MP2 would break down or fail miserably. So this is just one comment on the use of DFT. I mean, it has its failures, but the price-performance ratio is still unbelievably good.
Now, I feel like I'm half Scottish, half English, which is a great advantage because I can support or not support Scotland or England at will. And I feel almost exactly the same about DFT versus the other. I have not, because I've come from the outside, I have not. I think the point is that in principle, the quantum chemistry is systematically improvable. If, say, I'm working for my chemical industry and I have to produce results tomorrow, I'm going to use the DFT.
Is there a connection between your incremental method and Stokes?
Yes. Well, actually, there was even more of the talk about some of that that I would not be can talk about that separately.
All right. I propose that we thank our speaker again.